Afghans tell the U.S. don't leave, but don't stay long either. Today, Wednesday, November 20th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. U.S. and Afghan officials struggle to reach a deal that allows American troops to stay in Afghanistan past next year's withdrawal deadline. This Kabul resident says most Afghans want an agreement.
We want the American forces to stay. We want our military to receive training and support so we can be empowered to defend our own country.
Also, a Google ad that's a real tearjerker for Indians and Pakistanis.
I found myself cheering up, especially at the moment where the two long-lost friends meet and then, you know, hugging each other and getting soaked in the rain.
Plus, why everybody just loves a good conspiracy theory.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. American soldiers have been fighting and dying in Afghanistan for 12 years now, and they may be staying for a few years longer. Today, lengthy and rancorous negotiations between Washington and Kabul finally yielded a draft new security agreement. Secretary of State John Kerry announced the breakthrough. He also dismissed reports that Afghan officials were demanding a U.S. apology. The proposed deal would allow American troops to stay in Afghanistan past next year's withdrawal deadline. It still needs the approval of a grand assembly of Afghan elders, but most Afghans favor an agreement. That's what I heard from one Kabul resident who wants us to refer to him only as Shuaib. He's a member of the Afghan Young Leaders Initiative.
The mood on the ground among the youth, among different groups in society, is generally we just want this to be signed as quickly as possible. The problem is the media hype created by a small minority who unusually tend to be louder than the others. They seem to have created this atmosphere where it portrays a sense of doubt among the Afghan people, but the majority are very clear. We want the American forces to stay. We want the commitment of the international community to continue. We want our military to receive training and support so we can be empowered to defend our own country and prosper as Afghans.
You're saying most people want the U.S. military to stay at any level and for how long?
This is where opinions differ. As an Afghan, I can say with confidence that we would want the U.S. and the international forces to stay in Afghanistan as long as we need them. I mean, I know it might be a selfish thing to say, but as long as we feel like there's a need for support, until we feel like we are on our two feet and that we can defend our territorial integrity without assistance, we would appreciate that support. And of course, I mean, that might be asking for too much. If an American taxpayer hears this, he'd say, well, obviously you'd want free money, but I think that's the scenario we're in. If the assistance and support is cut instantaneously, I think the situation might go dark very, very quickly, unfortunately. So a continuation of the support is very crucial for the majority of Afghans.
Shuaib, there are also several other sticking points in the proposal. One of them is talk of Afghan officials requesting a letter from the U.S. admitting past American mistakes. Tell me about that.
Well, I would say that it's a bit of a media spin. That's my personal perspective. But mistakes have been made from many parties in Afghanistan, and we cannot hide that. But we also have to understand that the Afghan people are very, very appreciative of the general effort and support that has been provided over the past decade. Nobody is undermining the blood spilt and the sacrifices made by our international allies. If that's the impression that this media spin is giving, then I think that would be an unfair one, because people on the ground are generally very appreciative.
Another highly sensitive issue is whether U.S. troops are authorized to forcibly enter Afghan homes. And obviously no one anywhere in the world wants soldiers coming into their houses without permission. But in extraordinary circumstances, like in a dangerous zone where conflicts might be taking place, Why is that such a sticking point for President Karzai?
If I were to be in his shoes, I think he's in a tough position. And so, as you rightfully pointed out, nobody's happy with anyone forcing themselves into their home, let alone military forces. But I think Afghans generally understand that we are in a state of war. And unfortunately, we have seen far worse atrocities take place in our country in our past. I think push comes to shove, people will accept it, but there generally will be that resentment that, you know, it's more of a necessity than a choice at this point, clauses like this.
Shuaib, project yourself, say, a year and a half into the future. If the U.S. does pull out all its troops from Afghanistan next year, something that just might happen, what would that mean for someone like you?
But unfortunately, we live in a region where we have hostile elements surrounding us. And the U.S. forces and our international allies, they're the stabilizing factor so far. And the stabilizing component is removed. I don't foresee a very bright future year and a half from now if all the international troops leave.
I'm glad you can at least chuckle about it a bit, Shuaib. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Shuaib is a resident of Kabul. He was speaking with us earlier today. The decision to go to war in Afghanistan in 2001 and the one to go to war in Iraq 2 years later were, of course, defining moments in the presidency of George W. Bush. Another enduring memory from those years is that of then Vice President Dick Cheney supposedly calling the shots. But that's not the picture you get from Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. That's a new book by Peter Baker, White House correspondent for the New York Times. Baker dismisses what he calls the cartoonish view that Bush just did whatever Cheney told him. In fact, he quotes one source as saying Bush was the undisputed alpha male in the White House. It's just that Bush agreed with Cheney on most issues through much of his first term.
You know, there's a striking change between, say, 2003, when President Bush is about to go into Iraq, and 2007, when he's asked whether he should bomb Syria because they have a nuclear reactor. And in the first instance, 2003, he meets with all his advisors. They've got intel about where they think Saddam Hussein is. And then he kicks everybody else out except for Dick Cheney. He just wants to talk to Cheney before he makes this big decision, comes out of that meeting and says, go. That's the beginning of the Iraq War. By 2007, he's asked by the Israelis to bomb this nuclear facility in Syria. He meets with all his advisors. This time, he asks Cheney to give his position in front of everybody else. Cheney says they should go ahead and bomb the facility, that red lines matter, and they should do it for credibility's sake. And the president says, okay, does anybody agree? And no hands go up. So this time, rather than just relying on Cheney, he's shown that Cheney is isolated from the rest of the team and forced him to kind of confront it as Bush decides to try diplomacy instead.
I doubt there's a single moment, but do you think that that's kind of the beginning of the divergence between Bush and Cheney?
I think it's a series of moments. Yeah, I think that, you know, you could point to a number of different times when they begin to sort of head off in different directions. I think early in 2004, President Bush was not kept informed of a fight that was going on about the legality of the NSA surveillance program we're reading a lot about right now. Mm-hmm. And he was, I think, mad that he was kept in the dark about that. I think, you know, even Katrina, they were on, you know, different pages. The president asked the vice president to head up a task force on Katrina, and the vice president said no, didn't want to do that. But I particularly think, obviously, as Iraq just began to consume his presidency, he was looking for a different direction. He was looking to try more diplomacy. He was looking to kind of compromise on some of the more controversial programs that had been so disputed in the first term. And Cheney saw that as a dangerous divergence, a loss of will. And the two were heading in different directions.
What kind of relationship do Bush and Cheney have today?
Well, I think it's proper. I think it's respectful, but it's not close. I don't think they talk very often. I interviewed Cheney for the book. He said, we're not buddies. We weren't buddies. It was a professional relationship. They saw each other most recently in April during the opening of the Bush Presidential Library in Dallas. Cheney was there, and the president said nice things about him from the stage. But Cheney was seated in the audience with the children and the cabinet secretaries, and it was Condoleezza Rice who was on stage and had a speaking role. And if you went into the library afterward, you saw the way Bush wants his presidency to be remembered. And you saw exhibits on Iraq and freedom and PEPFAR, his AIDS program. You saw videos narrated by Condi Rice and Josh Bolton and Andy Card, a portrait of the First Lady, pictures of the daughters, even a statue of the dogs. But what you don't really see in his library is Dick Cheney. He doesn't really show up very much.
You know, one interesting insight from your book is the contrast between the severe doubts that Bush felt in private compared to the near swagger that he put out in public. It's a stark contrast to the mea culpas we've been hearing, especially lately, from President Obama.
Yeah, President Bush didn't believe in showing that kind of thing publicly. He took from LBJ's example of Vietnam a lesson that the presidents can't agonize in public, that if you show ambivalence in public, it sends a wrong message to not only the public, but to your troops, to the enemy, and so on. So to the extent that he was feeling great pressure from the war, he tried very hard to keep that to himself. But in private, you know, aides said that they noticed that he sometimes seemed almost despondent in meetings. Things are going so badly. At some points, one aide said it was like he was kind of, you know, willing us to not give him more bad news today. He clenched his jaw so much that his jaw was hurting. His wife would try to get his brother Marvin to come visit on weekends to kind of take his mind off the war. You know, I think it would weigh on any president.
What continuities do you see between the Bush White House and the Obama White House?
Well, more than we probably imagined. I think particularly when it comes to national security and foreign policy, the continuity between the White Houses of different parties is much greater than we think. The range of options is relatively limited. In this case, President Bush had moderated and shaved off the edges of a lot of his programs on national security so that by the time President Obama came in, he inherited most of them and made some further modifications but didn't toss them overboard. He ran against Bush's first term, in effect, but inherited Bush's second term. So we saw an increase in the drone program. We saw the continuation of indefinite detention at Guantanamo. We saw military commissions and surveillance, which we're reading a lot about these days in the news, continue. So, you know, in effect, President Obama has validated to some extent at least part of the Bush program.
I mean, you're a regular at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Peter. When you walk into the White House, what is the biggest difference that strikes you between Obama and Bush?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, what strikes me often is the similarities rather than the differences. I'm struck by here we are in the fifth year of a presidency. And once again, you know, you have a president in trouble. You know, the whole first term is organized around one thing, getting a second term, right? And that provides a president sort of an organizing principle and an end date, a goal, and a specific measure of success. Either you win or you lose. And on election day, both President Bush and President Obama could claim victory for a second term. Then you head into this fifth year where suddenly you're no longer running ever again, and you're trying to implement an ambitious agenda, and suddenly you find yourself frustrated. In Bush's case, obviously, it was the war in Iraq, and it was Hurricane Katrina. In President Obama's case, we see his frustration over Syria. We see the problems with the healthcare program and the government shutdown debates. And they're both, you know, at relatively similar places in this point of the presidency in terms of the polls. Now, the question is, can President Obama turn it around? President Bush had a hard time doing that. But there are lessons to be learned, probably.
Peter Baker, White House correspondent for The New York Times and author of Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney at the White House. Thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I was asked today, when was the last time I wore a tie? And I could not remember. So it's kind of encouraging to find out that my tie-wearing habits are in line with overall trends in menswear. Today, one of Britain's most well-known tie retailers, a chain called Tie Rack, announced it's closing almost all of its stores. Now, my dad wore a tie every day to work. For ages, a tie was just standard attire. And you don't have to relive the 1960s through Mad Men to know this. Just think back to 1981, when Tie Rack was founded in the London shopping mecca of Oxford Street. It was an overnight success. At its peak, it had 450 stores. Now, only a handful of Tie Racks will remain, relegated mostly to airports. You know, hasty, last-minute gifts from the waiting lounge. But hey, if Justin Timberlake has his way, we'll all be wearing them again soon.
And as long as I got my suit and tie, I'm gonna leave it all on the floor tonight. And you got fixed up to the lines, let me show you a few things. All dressed up in black and white, and you're dressed in that dress I like. Love is swinging in the air tonight.
Mr. Entertainment, this is PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's been painfully slow to arrive, but aid is now flowing into the Philippine city of Tacloban. It's one of the areas that was flattened by Typhoon Haiyan. Debris is finally getting picked up, and the bodies lying on the sides of the road are being collected and buried. And so people there are starting the rebuilding process. Aurora Amendral reports.
It's been more than a week since the storm, and members of the Vergara family have gathered back at their home in Costa Brava, one of the most devastated neighborhoods in Tacloban. Of the 10 of them, only 3 survived. 49-year-old Virgilio Padilla Vergara is now hammering together a simple frame for a new house on the ruins of their old one. He's using lumber and corrugated tin he gathered from the wreckage. He says he doesn't want to leave because it's a reminder of his parents, who both drowned in the storm surge. Costa Brava is flanked by the sea on one side and the bay on the other. The storm surge crushed every house in Costa Brava and swept away hundreds of people. Many of the bodies washed up in a neighborhood on the other side of the bay. Virgilio's sister, Leonora, was able to grab hold of a piece of wood while she was tossed in the flood for 3 hours. When the waters receded, she walked several kilometers back to Costa Brava. Three of her children died. Her 2-year-old was ripped from her arms. She says if she hadn't heard her eldest daughter alive and screaming for her, she would have let herself die too. Today, she's hanging up laundry on some downed electrical wire. The signs of recovery are apparent. The main road is cleared and most of the corpses have been taken away or placed in body bags. A week ago, Tacloban seemed hopeless, but now there's a sense that the city is starting to move forward. Still, Leonora says they'll have to clean the rubble of their home themselves, and there's still dead bodies buried in the wreckage of their neighborhood. Food aid is starting to trickle in, but only enough for a small meal once a day. Clean water is still hard to come by, and her daughter has a nasty, untreated gash on her scalp. Leonora is also worried about thieves taking what little they have left, and she's afraid that her daughter might get raped. As soon as it gets dark, the family, along with a few other survivors, barricade themselves in the shelter using corrugated tin. Her brother and a few other men in the neighborhood stay up all night keeping guard. It isn't easy, and there's still a lot of work to be done. Leonora said she would prefer to go to Manila to recover. She wants to be away from the destruction, and she knows she'd be safer there. But she wakes up thinking of her dead children every day. She spends her days walking the neighborhood and turning over debris, hoping to find them. If I could only just see their bodies, she says, that would help. She can't leave until she does, she says. That's why she's rebuilding here. For The World, I'm Aurora Almendral, Tacloban, Philippines.
You may have seen an ad for Google India bouncing around the internet, even on PRI.org. The ad features an older Indian man telling his granddaughter about his long-lost childhood friend who lives in Lahore in what is now Pakistan, where he used to live before the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947. As boys, they used to go to his friend's family sweet shop in Lahore. After hearing the story, his granddaughter Googles the sweet shop, then picks up the phone and calls them.
Hello, assalamu alaikum.
Fazal Sweets?
Hanji.
The granddaughter and the Pakistani man's grandson conspire, and the old friends are reunited. It's pretty darn touching. The World's Ritu Chatterjee was also moved by the ad. She's in Delhi, in India.
I found myself cheering up. Especially at the moment where the 2 long-lost friends meet and then, you know, hugging each other and getting soaked in the rain. So I found it quite moving.
What's your own personal connection, Ritu, to the partition? I cried as well, and I don't even have any connection to partition or India or Pakistan. Why do you think you teared up?
That's the thing, Marco. I actually don't have any personal connection with the partition as well. One side of my family has roots in Bangladesh, but nothing in Pakistan. But, you know, living in northern India especially, you have friends. You have friends of friends, relatives of friends. Many, many people still have connections with Pakistan. In fact, just the other day, a couple of days after I saw the ad, I was at a friend's parents' place having tea. And we started talking about the ad. My friend's father said he was moved by it. His wife then started telling stories about her family's connections with Lahore, which is where her family was from. So the stories are all around you. The other thing is, Marco, that this theme of parting with people, you know, losing an old friend, a family member, or lovers, parting and reuniting is a big cultural theme here in India. You see it in Bollywood films, you read it in stories, you read it in poetry. So that's a big part of the culture here, just even outside of the partition. So the ad very cleverly taps into, one, the existing sort of sentimentality of Indians and their connection with this theme of parting and reunition. And then obviously the story is connected with partition.
I mean, part of what made me so sad when I saw this is that this ad for Google purports to show reconnection and reunion. You know, that historical fork in the road with partition, it's actually a pretty easy one to get around. Just go on Google and, you know, find out where people live. Why don't more people do this?
Well, that's the thing, Marco, and that's been the one sort of criticism of the ad. The fact is that it's not easy. So it's an unrealistic ad. For a Pakistani to get a visa to India, it's incredibly difficult. You know, there are thousands, perhaps millions of people wanting to reunite with their friends and long-lost family members, and they can't do it because of the visa requirements.
How hard is it to get a visa then? I mean, of those millions of people, is there only a handful getting visas to travel?
I don't know the exact numbers, but I've read that activists on both sides of the borders are actively pursuing efforts to force the governments to relax visa rules. And the fact is that even when they do get visas, they are humiliated when they come to the other side. Say, for example, I was just reading this article in the Indian Express newspaper written by an Indian woman who lives in the U.S. with her Pakistani husband. And she was saying, you know, even though she and her husband have visited both India and Pakistan, they have to go through very humiliating questioning by government officials. They're made to feel like criminals. And, you know, they recognize that they are privileged. For the poor people, it's even harder.
Has this ad touched a nerve in Pakistan as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was just chatting with a Pakistani journalist friend of mine in Lahore. She was saying that, interestingly enough, this ad has led her and her friends to discuss about how their grandparents, who are no longer around, and that in their last years, they talked so fondly of India that at the end of their lives, they were thinking a lot about India. You know, it has really touched a nerve on both sides. I mean, there are real people with real connections and real emotional attachments on both sides.
The World's Ritu Chatterjee in Delhi. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
If you want to see the moment where these two old friends reunite, you can watch Google's ad at PRI.org. Get your hankies out. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, a reporter goes to the former Soviet city of Minsk to meet people who remember Lee Harvey Oswald. One of them made a strange request.
He asked me if I would lay some flowers on Oswald's grave if I ever found myself in Dallas-Fort Worth, where he's buried, and I really didn't know how to answer that.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston. One of the Arctic 30 is out of jail. She's a Brazilian activist who walked out of a courtroom in St. Petersburg, Russia today, holding a sign that said, "Save the Arctic." She was the first to be released out of a group of 30 Greenpeace activists who were arrested in September after protesting Russian oil drilling in the Arctic. Bail hearings continue for the others. Anton Benislavsky is a Russian lawyer on the Greenpeace legal team. He told me earlier that the release today was a measure of progress, but that overall the trial of the Arctic 30 is a political circus. Tell me, Anton, do you have faith in the Russian legal system?
No.
And why not?
I worked for 10 years as a corporate lawyer, and it was something personal for me that I saw how the justice has died. So, now I see that it's more the administrative body than the body of justice. And that's why I see more politics in our courts than law.
Can you just summarize for us what happened today in the St. Petersburg courtroom?
We have some bail decisions on activists of Arctic 30, with only one decision to extend the detention for Colin Russell from Australia. The first activist which was released from the jail is Anna Paula from Brazil. Now she's free, and we're waiting for other activists to be free after all the formal procedures with the bail will be finished.
Right, because I gather activists also from Argentina, Canada, and Italy have also been granted bail. You expect they'll be freed, at least pending trial, in the next couple of days?
Yes, because in Russian Federation, this procedure is quite long. After the decision of the bail, after granting the bail, you need to fulfill bail payment. And after that, the lawyer can take this document and go to the CISO to release his client. With Anna Power, it took 2 days. This is the great progress for this case. So we will pay all our attention to the case of Colin Russell, because he's the only activist who now has the extension of the detention.
He's the man from Australia, is that right?
Yes, yes. His case was the first.
Why don't you just tell me how Ana Paula looked when she was released today, the Brazilian activist?
One who leaves the jail should look like very happy. Now she's has a chance to spend first night not in the jail, but in a more pleasant place.
Anton Benislavsky, a lawyer with Greenpeace Russia, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Back in the late 1950s, Russia seemed an appealing place to Lee Harvey Oswald. He'd later become the man who shot John F. Kennedy. That was a half century ago. Oswald defected to the Soviet Union in 1959. At least he tried to. But the Soviets didn't want him at first. They eventually relented and sent him to Minsk, now part of Belarus. Reporter David Stern recently visited Minsk on the trail of Lee Harvey Oswald's time there. He told me the Soviets created a job for Oswald.
They found him a job at a radio and TV factory, and they gave him a very, very nice apartment in the very center of town, which I actually visited.
So you met people in Minsk who knew Oswald at the time. What did they tell you about him?
That's right. I met a number of people who knew him. One of the first people that I met was a woman named Ina Markova. She met Oswald originally when she was a student. She went to the opera with one of her girlfriends, and Oswald and one of his friends approached them, and they struck up a conversation, and she had this to say about him.
He laughed so loudly that at that time it was very strange that a person could laugh so loudly in the street.
Was he the first American a lot of these people in Minsk met?
Yes, he was. He was somewhat of a minor celebrity, at least for a while, when he lived there. But I was also told that after a while, people grew tired of him because they began to realize that beyond being an American and being able to speak English with him, and there wasn't a whole lot else to him, and they kind of grew bored of him.
So once these former acquaintances of Oswald in Minsk found out that he had shot JFK, what did they make of that?
Well, they didn't believe it, and they still don't believe it, to be honest. I didn't meet a person there who thought that Lee Harvey Oswald was, in fact, the assassin of President Kennedy. One of the people that I spoke to was, in fact, one of his best friends when he was in Minsk, a man named Ernst Titovits, and he had this to say about finding out about the Kennedy assassination and then Oswald's own murder.
Well, first, I didn't believe my ears that it was exactly that person. To me, the United States at that time was absolutely unknown country. I knew nothing about that. To me, the United States was as if populated by ghosts. And the only real person there was Lee. And suddenly, it turned out that those ghosts were dangerous. And the real person I knew was assassinated also.
Wow. The dangerous ghosts of the United States. How do the people of Minsk view Oswald now?
Well, not many people in Minsk really know that Oswald lived there, aside from obviously the people who knew him. There are no plaques announcing where Oswald lived or worked. And in fact, when I tried to speak to people at the places where he worked, I was flatly refused in a very Soviet way. But I guess their attitude was no good thing could come from this and probably some grief if they said the wrong thing.
David, what was the most surprising thing you heard about Oswald when you were there?
Well, the most surprising thing that happened to me was a request that I got from a man who worked with Oswald at the radio and TV factory, a man named Vladimir Zhidovich. We met for an interview, and he remembered Oswald very fondly, thought of him as a quote-unquote good guy. And at the end of the interview, when we were packing up and getting ready to go out back on the street, he asked me if I would lay some flowers on Oswald's grave if I ever found myself in Dallas-Fort Worth, where he's buried. And that took me back. I wasn't expecting that, and I really didn't know how to answer that. Mr. Zhidovich really seemed to be, you know, quite sincere. And it's not often that you, you know, turn down that sort of heartfelt request. And so I really didn't know what to say to him, to be honest.
You still on the fence about that one? It's a tough one.
Like I say, it's a difficult one to make up my mind, but I don't think I'm going to be laying flowers on Oswald's grave. I can't bring myself to do that. But I will say that I thought about it a long time.
Reporter David Stern on the trail of Lee Harvey Oswald's 2.5 years in Minsk. Great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Oswald's friends in Minsk didn't believe he killed JFK, which puts them in good company. Lots of Americans doubt the official word on Kennedy's assassination. It was the quintessential narrative to trigger conspiracy theories. But it's not the only one. Here's the world's Alex Galifant.
Let's begin with September 11th, 1973. The date of the military coup in Chile. On that day, Chile's socialist president, Salvador Allende, committed suicide in the presidential palace. The official story is that as troops loyal to General Augusto Pinochet stormed the building, Allende shot himself with a rifle. Conspiracy theorists have long argued that Allende was assassinated. In 2011, an independent forensics expert, Luis Ravenal, spoke to the Paris-based Euronews.
The report and the conclusions that I wrote established the existence of at least two projectiles, two impact wounds from bullets of two different weapons.
Later in 2011, Allende's body was exhumed. A group of international forensic experts examined it and concluded suicide. The case was closed in 2012. But many remain unconvinced, and not just about Allende's death. Coincidentally, or not, one of President Allende's close friends died only days after him, apparently of natural causes. That was the Chilean poet and communist Pablo Neruda. A conspiracy theory claims he was poisoned on orders from General Pinochet. And so this year, Neruda's body was exhumed and examined. Conclusion, natural causes. But here's Neruda's nephew.
We will continue to investigate what he really did die of, because more clarity is needed.
Uncertainty. Any uncertainty at all. That's oxygen for the conspiracy theory. And that's why the unexpected deaths of national figures are such fertile ground for theorists.
They are typically very difficult to comprehend at the kind of national level. We don't expect them to happen.
Viren Swamy studies the psychology of conspiracy theories at the University of Westminster in London.
Information about those kinds of events tends to be incomplete. And so when you want a fuller picture of what's going on, you might, for example, adopt a conspiracy theory in order to understand that event.
Swamy says that in academic circles, conspiracy theorizing used to be seen as a pathology, a kind of paranoia. But he and other scholars are taking a different tack by asking, what need does a conspiracy theory serve?
It allows for the voicing of an opinion among people who are powerless or disadvantaged, offering a means of almost replying to and questioning mainstream thinking.
Cambridge University recently launched a conspiracy and democracy research project. Among other things, it's looking at the influence of the giant Google-shaped elephant in the room. With so much information at our fingertips, and in global terms at least, very little power, it might be that people feel they can only make sense of the world by positing global conspiracy theories of shadowy people meeting in secret. And, says Richard Evans, who's leading the Cambridge project, because we expect to be able to access any information anywhere, we also demand ever more transparency from our governments.
And the problem with that is that government can never be completely transparent. There have to be some secrets in government, some confidentiality, and so that breeds distrust.
Now, distrust in government is healthy to a degree. Some conspiracy theories, even if incorrect, have likely forced the release of more information, simply by publicly challenging official accounts. But the challenging often doesn't go far enough. Conspiracy theorists rarely question their own theories. But there is another reason conspiracy theories persist. Real conspiracies do exist. Any one conspiracy theory can be a deep, dark rabbit hole of irrationality, of madness even. But because conspiracies happen, the conspiracy theory can't ever be entirely dismissed. For the World, I'm Alex Galifant.
There are a few conspiracy theories in the world of soccer, too. But that's not what soccer fans are focused on this week. They've been riveted by the last qualifying international matches, setting the stage for next year's World Cup in Brazil. And there's one fan here in our newsroom who just can't wait until next June.
Can we move this along already?
Yeah, that would be the world's William Troop. So, William, what are the highlights from these latest World Cup qualifiers?
Well, first of all, there's no Iceland. Iceland did not make it to the World Cup.
They were really upset
by Croatia. And so Iceland will not become the smallest country ever to qualify for the World Cup. That's still going to be Trinidad and Tobago. But really, soccer-wise, the major headline is that a new chapter has been written in this endless saga of who is the best soccer player out there in the world. Is it Lionel Messi of Argentina or Cristiano Ronaldo of Portugal? Now, I have to say, after yesterday, you got to go with Cristiano Ronaldo. He's played a fantastic game. Portugal beat Sweden to make it to the World Cup through a playoff, and it's going to be a tough act to follow for Messi to do better at the World Cup.
I'm still heartbroken about Iceland, but it does seem like a few countries had some of their pride restored by their soccer heroes on the field.
Yep, France is the first one on that list. They were on the brink of elimination, but they came back, beat Ukraine by 3-0, and this pall of pessimism that had fallen over France sort of suddenly lifted, and they have their successful multicultural team back, and everybody's happy. Greece also gave something for Greeks to cheer about by making it to the World Cup at the expense of Romania. And lastly, I wanted to mention Egypt. They did not make it to the World Cup. They still lost to Ghana, which beat them by, I don't know, a lot of goals. but they did win their last playoff game against Ghana, which wasn't enough. But basically, again, the Egyptian players gave their country, which has been through so much turmoil, at least one victory to remember this by.
And what about our friends to the south in Mexico? They were facing a playoff against New Zealand. How'd they do?
Well, talk about restored pride. I mean, they were dependent on the U.S. to even make it to a playoff. We talked about that a few weeks back. So they beat New Zealand. But the interesting thing there is how they beat New Zealand. They actually built a team entirely dependent on players who play in Mexico. And they ignored all the high-paid, high-profile players, Mexican players who play in Europe. They left them at home, concentrated on their homegrown and home-played talent, and they beat New Zealand easily. And that's worth noting in a world where all the best players head to Europe and the national teams depend on that.
So, William, now that we know who's going to be at the World Cup next year, care to go out on a limb and give us a prediction?
You know, it might sound boring, but I think Brazil's going to win it. It's going to be really hard for anybody other than Brazil to come out the winner when Brazil is playing at home.
Yeah, I saw somebody post a picture of the new Maracanã Stadium on Facebook the other day. They were just beating their chest with pride. That is going to be a tough one. The world's William Troop, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
By the way, every World Cup has music that goes with it. 3 years ago in South Africa, there was an official concert before the soccer games were played, and one of the musicians on hand to perform for the fans in Soweto was the Malian singer and guitarist Vieux Farka Touré. He visited our studios recently, and he performed a great solo rendition of one of the tracks from his latest album, Mon Pays, or My Country. We caught that on video, and you can see it at PRI.org. Bakoy there from Vieux Farka Touré. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and I'm not Irish, as some think. It's not the O'Werman family. It's Marco Werman. That's my real name, but The World's language editor, Patrick Cox, is here to talk about fake names, pseudonyms. Patrick, that is your real name, right?
Oh, sure. But, you know, I was thinking that Patrick O'Werman, that'd be nice, right? We could both reinvent ourselves that way. And that's the point of taking on a pseudonym. It is reinventing yourself. It's rebirth. And it always seems to be that, even if the specifics of the motives are very different. I mean, think of a couple of high-profile examples this year. You've got Carlos Danger, you know, Anthony Weiner. Also, thriller writer Robert Galbraith, usually known as J.K. Rowling.
Right.
And here's an even more intriguing one. The writer Salman Rushdie, he famously had to assume a fake name when he was forced into hiding after that fatwa was issued against him. Here he is talking about that.
It was a thing that cropped up within a few moments of the police protection beginning, when it became clear that I would need a pseudonym. So they asked me to think of one, and then they said, don't use an Indian name because that'll be too obvious. This is a very strange thing, to be asked to surrender your name and also give up the ethnicity of your name. And so I thought, well, if I have to surrender ethnicity, I'll retreat into literature. And eventually settled on a name which was concocted from the first names of Conrad and Chekhov. So it became Joseph Anton. My bank manager was in on the secret. That was it. I could write checks in that. I could rent properties in that. So it became my name. I hated it.
Yeah, it's like he hated it, Marco, because he had no choice but to adopt it.
Right. As opposed to this next story about changing your name, told by writer and musician Alina Simone in New York.
I was born with the name Alina Alexandrovna Vilenkina. One day, I received a letter addressed to Alina Vileskin, and I realized that just by changing one letter of my last name, Vilenkin became Vileskin. At the time, I was hoping to become a solo singer. And I wanted a last name that was a little less easy to mangle. So I decided to legally change my last name from my father's to my mother's last name, which was Simone. When you come from another country and you have a complicated last name, you're disclosing a lot about yourself without ever voluntarily disclosing it. So what changing your name allows you to do is sort of control who knows what about you. And I'm very proud of being Slavic. I've recorded a Russian language album. I've toured in Russia as a Russian-American singer. I've written books that focus a lot on the Russian-American experience. But I like being able to tell people that I'm Russian or that I was born in Ukraine instead of sort of having my name reveal it all for me. I like being able to choose my name. I like being Alina Simone. The only drawback is that people think I stole my name from Nina Simone. And I always tell them she was born Eunice Wayman. In 1998, I legally changed my name, and that's when I really became a singer. I started playing shows in New York City, recording albums, eventually touring the country, touring Europe, and before I know it, I've made a name for myself. Then about 2 years ago, a man comes up to me at a show and says, I just think you ought to know something. A woman that I'm friends with saw your name on a vinyl record and she decided to change her name to yours. At first, it was just one of those funny pieces of information that you kind of keep in your back pocket for cocktail party chatter. My friends started to joke that maybe she was parked outside my apartment in a white van, or that I should change my name to the artist originally known as Alina Simone. But after a while, the humor kind of gave way to curiosity, because I started out as someone who wasn't Alina Simone either, and it changed my life to take this new name, and I kind of wondered how her year as Alina Simone went. So I decided to get in touch with her. So I got back in touch with our mutual acquaintance, and I shot her an email. It was just before Christmas. She agreed to meet me at a bar in Midtown, and there she was, the other Alina Simone. The first thing I learned when I sat down with Alina was that she had only changed her first and middle names to my name. She had actually held on to her maiden name. And then I learned the story of why she had changed her name to mine. She was Brazilian and had moved to this country in order to marry a man she had fallen in love with. And they'd been married for many years when one morning she discovered him Skyping with a woman she didn't recognize. She asked him who it was, and he said, "It's just business," to which she replied, "It's Saturday." And in the space of one day, her marriage unraveled, and with it, her life. And at the time when she walked into my show and saw my vinyl record propped up, she was actually actively shopping for a new name. I think that people change their names for the same reasons that they move to big cities. There's something incredibly freeing about anonymity. And a name, in a way, is like a time capsule. I mean, it contains all the history of your family and the expectations of your family and your own expectations for yourself. And when those expectations are unmet, it can be really revolutionary to just shed that name and start all over again. That's how I see it, at least.
Writer and musician Alina Simone there. And your own name, have you taken a pseudonym? If so, why'd you change it? Let us know at PRI.org or tweet us using the hashtag YourWorld. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org, the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.